When did you go from having a strictly comedic career to speaking about suicide and depression?
Yeah, it was about the point where I had the gun in my mouth. I thought, oh, wait, I tried to... people go, hi, what's funny about depression and suicide? Nothing funny, but there are funny moments. There is organic humor. It was... I always wanted to do, I was born a comedian. I came, you know, people ask, were you born funny? Yeah, a funny thing happened all the way down the birth canal. I was born funny. My whole family's funny. So I knew from the time, fourth grade, I wanted to be a comedian. After I became a professional comedian, I always wanted to do that, but somehow make a difference in people's lives. You know, go from being a funny speaker to a speaker who was funny. But I could never figure out what I had to share with anybody that they would learn anything. And then when I came so close to ending my life, I realized what I should be doing with my life. And I read a book by a woman named Judy Carter. It's called The Message of You, Turning Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. And I picked up the book, and I'm halfway through it thinking I don't have anything to tell anybody, teach anybody. And then it hit me. My grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. My great aunt died by suicide. My mother and I found her. I was 4 years old. I'll spare you the details. If you'd like to know what happened at that moment, it's in my first TED Talk, called A Matter of Laugh, L-A-U-G-H, or Death. And then, of course, I came very close in 2010. It's called Generational Depression and Suicide. It runs in my family. And so I realized when I got done with Judy's book, I've got something to say. And then I used her book and another book called Talk Like TED, The 9 Things That Should Be in Every Great TED Talk, created my TED Talk, got booked, did it. And that, by the way, was the first time anybody that I knew, family, friends, whatever, acquaintances, knew I was depressed and had thoughts of suicide. Matter of fact, when it posted on YouTube, my wife's about to hit play to see how it turned out, and I had to stop her. I go, look, we need to chat before you push play, because you're about to learn a half a dozen things about me you had no idea. So I didn't want to learn about me putting a gun in my mouth by watching me do it on stage, you know, on YouTube. So that was my coming out, and that's when I began rebranding from comedian to speaker.
Did you find that it was easier to talk about it as you got more experience speaking before crowds, or has it kind of been easy for you to talk about from the beginning?
The TED Talk was the most difficult. You know, it's like coming out about anything. I've got friends who have come out to their parents. Mom, Dad, we need to have a chat, sit down, it's very serious. I'm depressed and having thoughts of suicide. And they're like, oh, God, I was hoping you were gay. You know, that's... So it's that coming out. And a friend of mine is getting ready to do another TED Talk. I helped her get her first one. The second one's on how do you come out as mentally ill to your friends and family? And then how do you come out as not only mentally ill, but suicidal? Because there's a set of stigma around mental illness and there's a set of stigma around suicidal. So her TED Talk's going to be all about how do you come out effectively to your friends and family if you have these issues. But once I'd started talking about it, then it's and now it's very therapeutic. Every time I do my keynote, every time I speak at a college or whatever, I get a little farther back from the edge because it's just, you know, talking about it has a therapeutic value for me as well.
What else have you done or what have you tried?
Well, my first thoughts of suicide that I recall were in the mid-80s when I was married to my first wife and miserable, selling insurance, miserable, not pursuing comedy, miserable. My fourth TED Talk is called Suicide, The Secret of My Success. Dead man talking. And what I realized was I'm married, miserable, working in insurance. It's a great business, but I was miserable. And I was not doing what I thought I should be doing, is going to open mic night and pursuing comedy, miserable. And I realized if I didn't change something sooner rather than later, I was going to kill myself, which was an amazingly empowering thought because I thought, okay, I quit my job, divorce my wife, try comedy. If it works, great. If not, hell, I can still kill myself. So I did not kill myself. I tried comedy. And that was 84. Ish and 95, the depression got really bad one day. It seemed like I was in California, in San Diego. Coronado is a little island off San Diego. It's gorgeous. And there's the world's best dog off-leash park between the Hotel Del Coronado and the Navy base. It's off-leash. It's the beach. It's Coronado. And we had a great afternoon, the dog and I. But I was wretchedly depressed. And my depression is not situational. Things were going great. Money in the bank, lots of bookings, condos paid for, happy wife, you know. So I thought, well, as I'm going up the Coronado Bridge, which people jump off all the time, I thought, as I'm going up the bridge in my car, I thought, I'll count my blessings, which people tell you to do. So I counted my blessings. I got to the top, still wanted to jump. And I thought, you know, we need to take a little something, something. So I found a supplement called SAMe, S-A-M-E. The chemical name is a lot longer. But turns out they did a double-blind study, and it's as good on mild depression as some of the early antidepressants. So I began taking 400 milligrams a day in the morning on an empty stomach, and that took the edge off. 5 o'clock is my worst time of day. I can, without a watch, I can tell you when it's 4:45. So that lasted until I was 60, and it was still working pretty well. And I exercise. I have two nap/meditations, cat nappers a day. Diet. I watch my diet very carefully. And my wife, when I turned 60, goes, "Look, you're 60. Ask your doctor, family physician, if there isn't something, you know, a psychotropic that he would recommend for what you have." So I went in, and he's supposed to ask me. In the U.S., every doctor, when you have a visit, is supposed to ask you these two questions, gateway questions, you know. Have you been sad or whatever in the last 2 weeks? And have you felt hopeless in the last 2 weeks? And if you answer yes to one or the other, then there's seven more questions, but my doctor never asked. So I volunteered, "Well, I have these two illnesses, major depressive disorder, chronic suicidality." And from the look on his face, he's like, "Oh, well, so he prescribed Wellbutrin." Now, I'm not advertising Wellbutrin. It just happened to work for me. Sometimes a crapshoot with antidepressants. Although, and your listeners may not know this, most people I know don't know this, there's now a cheek swab DNA test for psychotropics. They do a cheek swab like Ancestry.com. They send it off to the lab, and they match it to a long list of antipsychotics, antidepressants, and they try to find the ones that work best with your metabolism. So if you go online and Google DNA cheek swab test, psychotropics, or, you know, depression drugs, you'll find three or four companies that do that. A couple $100, most insurances cover it, and it helps you avoid the lab rat, you know, go on, taper off. I got lucky. 2 weeks in, my wife noticed the difference in my personality. I mean, I'm a happy guy mostly anyway, but she noticed it 2 weeks in. She didn't say anything. She thought she'd wait till I noticed. 3 weeks in, I noticed. And I had this thought unbidden for the first time since high school. And bear in mind, I have a good life. I get paid to talk. I have a lovely wife. We own a house out the river in Oregon. It's a dump, but it's our dump, and a really nice neighborhood. A lot of old people, sort of the grumpy cast of Cocoon. Anyway, I had this thought for the first time since I was in high school. I like my life. My second thought was, "Oh my God, that's the antidepressant, and what the F was I waiting for? Why didn't I do this a long time ago?" Because, you know, there are people who have personal prejudice against psychotropics, drugs. "I would never take drugs for..." Well, yeah, because you're not depressed. I mean, if it comes down to, you know, swallowing a pill or a bullet, what would you choose? And sometimes for people, it comes down to that very thing. I believe in a holistic approach, not just pharmaceutical. But so I started taking an antidepressant when I was 60, and it's just enough to take the edge off around 5 o'clock, and it doesn't mean I don't get depressed every now and then, which I do. It shortened the cycle from 3 days to 2, and it happens less often. But I can, you know, and I have triggers, things. If I disappoint my wife, that's a trigger for me. I can feel myself being, you know, circling downwards. Now we've made a joke out of it. I'll do something stupid. And I'll go, "You mad at me?" She goes, "I'm not mad. No, I'm disappointed." Which, because we can speak about it openly, you know, she's not blindsided by my depression. She knows that that's where I am. But even to this day, I was depressed one day. I'm in the driveway. I'm doing some yard work. She's getting ready to go to work. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm depressed. I should tell her. And then I thought, you know, why tell her? I'm not going to feel any better, and she's just going to feel worse. And that's why people oftentimes don't tell other people, normal people, because they don't want to burden them with, you know, I mean, every now and then when somebody says something stupid like, "You need to choose joy." Don't you think if that was that easy, I would have done that decades ago? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You're just looking for attention.
It's more frequent than people might believe.
Yeah. 1 in 4 people on average have some sort of something going on.
Yeah. And another argument I've heard is, like, everyone has something now. Like, we're over-medicating everyone.
Yeah.
So that also kind of plays into people not pursuing medication when it could improve their life quality. So how would you suggest talking to the men in your life? How would you suggest kind of broaching that subject and trying to get them to open up?
Well, what I would do, as I said, men tend to be open to other men as a mentor. My wife will tell you. She can have a great idea. I'll poo-poo it. If the mailman tells me the same idea, I'm all over it. In Billings, there's an outfit called NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. And their thing is not so much for the person who has the illness or mental illness, but for the friends or family of people who do. So they have classes. Let's say you have a child who's schizophrenic and you're just at your wit's end as a family. You go, there's 12 weeks, one day a week, it's all free. They teach you what to say, how to say it, what not to say. They help you find resources. They have family-to-family counseling. NAMI's sort of like, you know, there's Alcoholics Anonymous. And then there's Al-Anon for people who are living with an alcoholic. How do you relate to an alcoholic is what they teach you. How do you keep yourself safe and help them? And so NAMI's like that. How do you keep yourself safe and then help the person with mental illness? I volunteer for them. I've done several fundraisers, and I'm on stage going, do you have any idea how much you can do, how much good work you can do when you don't charge anything to get people to donate money to the organization? So,
and have you found many men coming up to you after your talk saying, hey, I've kind of dealt with the same kind of thing?
Yes, although I must tell you, at colleges, it's about 90-95% women who come to the events. Because, you know, man, I don't need help. I'm my guy, you know. But men do tend to come up afterwards, I think because I've exposed myself. I've been vulnerable. They see another man who's up there, you know, saying, I love the song by Big and Rich. It's somebody has to be unafraid to lead the freak parade. That's my job, is to lead the freak parade, to come out and go, look, I'm crazy. And my family, more nuts than a 25-pound bag of squirrel food. We're just all, you know. But that's my generation, my sisters. The generation before ours, they didn't talk about it. It wasn't, the good news is in our generation, because all of the cousins are upfront about it, then all the nieces and nephews have no problem saying, look, coming out about whatever, because they know there's no stigma attached to it.
How important is it to have talks like yours addressing depression and different taboo subjects for men? How important is that to getting rid of this reluctance to talking about men's feelings, men's experiences, moments of vulnerability, and things like that?
Wait a minute now. Men's feelings? I don't really know. no concept. No. It is terribly important. Again, because if 7 out of 10 suicides in the country are men age 45, 54... And part of the problem is they're not forthcoming. That's why we did the book, the anthology. It's called Guts, Grit, and the Grind, Men's Mental Fitness Manual. And we don't think men are going to buy it. We designed it in such a way they can safely. We designed it to look like an automobile owner's manual. It's full of automobile metaphors. Don't you wish guys had like a check engine light? Go see their, you know, mental mechanic. You plug in. Oh, Bob, man, are you depressed? You're like 3 quarts low. It's full of that kind of metaphor. We think what's going to happen is women are going to buy it for the men in their lives. They're going to look and they go, oh, they're going to hit the index and go, that guy's got the same problem my husband does. And it's full of not only the story, but the clinical advice on what to do if you have someone in your life that you love that has these issues. Now, the story is really for the men. A man reading a story of another man who had the similar struggle and how is he coping. So I think it's extremely important because, you know, 47,000 suicides a year and 7 out of 10 of them are men. We're going to run out at some point.
Do you think men who are a little bit younger have an easier time talking about their depression, or do you feel like it's just men in general have a problem?
I think men in general have a problem. And you know, women actually attempt suicide more often than men. However, men, when they attempt, often use a gun, and there's no coming back. You know, I mean, I have an acquaintance who shot himself in the chest and survived. Woke up in ICU and thought, man, am I a loser? I can't even kill myself. But normally, with a gun, you know, you slice your wrist or take too many pills or whatever. It's still time to make a phone call, help. I've taken too many pills, or somebody comes home, finds you unconscious, you know, make you throw up. But yeah, so women attempt more often, but men follow through more.
Why do you think there's that different approach?
Well, one thing is, and please look, I'm not an anti-gun nut. I'm a nut, but I'm not anti-guns. I have to have an own too, for protection and so forth. We live out in the woods. I carry one when I walk the dogs in the woods, mostly for cougars and bears. Of course, we live in Oregon, you know, the occasional meth producer. But it's just that men tend to choose weapons. And in the U.S., weapons are, you know, guns are readily available. It's Now, that said, you take the gun away from a man who is truly suicidal, he's going to figure out a way. There's a school teacher in my little town there who had gotten arrested for something indecent with one of his students, and they came and took his gun, and the next day he hanged himself. So it doesn't mean it won't happen, but for some reason, and I don't know the research, why women choose other means and why men tend to choose guns, but because they make that choice, they tend to, you know, complete the suicide.
So you said that with college audiences, a lot of the people who come to the event are women. What's going to be the topic of conversation for your talk coming up at MSUB?
It would be depression, suicide, signs, symptoms, and solutions. How do you know if your roommate or suite mate or whatever has depression? How do you know? How do you know if they're having thoughts of suicide? So I give them symptoms, things to look for. Okay, let's say you think they are depressed. What do you say? More importantly, what don't you say? You know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, turn that frown upside down, choose joy. Have you tried fish oil? Exercise, meditate. Then if you realize they are depressed, or they're upfront about it, yes, I am terribly depressed, then you have to ask them flat out, are you having thoughts of suicide? There's an urban legend that you should never mention the S word, suicide, in front of somebody who's depressed. And I love the reasoning as a comedian because it might give them the idea. Suicide? What a great idea. Why didn't I think of that? Trust me, it's crossed their mind. So if they say they are having thoughts of suicide, you have to say, do you have a plan? And if they say yes, what is your plan? If they're depressed and having thoughts of suicide and have a plan and it's detailed, do not leave them alone if at all possible. If you have to leave, try to find somebody to take your place. And your job at that moment as sort of a mental health first responder, like an EMT, you can't fix them, but you can maybe stabilize them, is to get them on the phone with the Suicide Prevention Lifeline or have them text the word CONNECT to 741-741, because sometimes young people are more forthcoming in text than they are on the phone. And if they won't pick up the phone, you pick up the phone, you call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and the volunteer will do whatever they can, as best they can, to get the phone into the hand of the person who is having thoughts of suicide. Now, the question always comes up, when do you call the cops? If they are a danger to themselves, imminent danger to themselves or others, you have no choice but to call the police and get the police involved. Dial 911. And let's say you got a call from a friend across town and you didn't like the way the conversation was going. You thought from what you heard and what you heard from the guy who spoke on campus that I think, for example, I talked to somebody this morning. His cousin said to somebody, a mutual acquaintance, well, this will be the last time I see you. And that's the kind of thing, you know, where you're like, oh my, I think she's going to end her life. Here for the listeners are signs for depression for the listeners. Lets their personal hygiene go. Students especially has trouble getting to an 8 o'clock class but rallies in the afternoon. Withdrawn from social activities in which they used to take great joy. Isolation, live in a dorm, moved off campus or moved away. Those are classic signs of depression. Signs they may be considering suicide. And these also, these overlap for depression and suicide. Eat too much, can't eat. Sleep too much, can't sleep. Those are common to depression and thoughts of suicide. Collecting the means to die by suicide, whether it's pills or buying a gun and ammunition. Constantly talking about death or dying. Googling death or dying. Or if they're an artist or a writer, it appears as a theme in their artwork or writing. If they, this is a big one, if they're giving away prized possessions. Because they want to make sure when they're gone, those possessions go to the person they want them to go to. If they give away a pet, that's top of the pyramid. And here's a counterintuitive one. If the person you're dealing with has been depressed, and then all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, happy beyond measure, it may mean they've chosen time, place, and method, and they know the pain is going to end. And by the way, that's another misconception. People say, I can't believe you wanted to die. I didn't want to die. Anthony Bourdain probably didn't want to die. Kate Spade didn't want to die, probably. We all just wanted to end the pain. Same reason people drink or do drugs oftentimes is to end the pain. Here's a deal that I think normal people don't understand, generally, neuronormal, neurotypical, don't understand is they have resilience classes, teach people to be resilient. The mentally ill people I know are the most resilient people I know. Because people who don't have a mental illness have no concept of the courage and strength and energy it takes to get out of bed in the morning, put one foot in front of the other, paste on a smile, and walk through the world as if nothing is wrong, until it's a socially acceptable time to go back to bed, pull the covers over your head. Having a mental illness is like this. There's a character in Greek mythology named Sisyphus. He's punished by the gods. They make him roll a rock up a hill every day, and right before he gets it to the top, it rolls back down. So the next morning, he's got to do the same thing. Having a mental illness is like that. Every morning you wake up, there's a rock and a hill. Some days the rock is small and the hill is not so steep. Some day the rock is a boulder and the hill is Everest. But every day, there's a rock and a hill, and every day you have to move the rock up the hill. And people like Anthony Bourdain, because people ask me after Anthony Bourdain passed away, because it looked like he had everything to live for, Kate Spade, same story, why would they end their lives? And I said, I think they just wore out. They got tired of living. They woke up one morning and they could not move the rock. I woke up one morning and I could not move the rock. So the reason I'm on campus here today, tonight, is to make sure, if at all possible, that everybody who hears me speak will be able to continue moving the rock.
What do you want the takeaway to be?
Silence kills. I want to start conversations. I want people to feel free after they hear me speak to say to a roommate, a friend, you know what that guy said about depression or about suicide or about, that's me. That's me all over. I have those thoughts all the time. So that the other people know, and they also know from what I said, how better to support that person. I tell the audience, look, here's the deal. If you're suicidal, call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline or text the Lifeline. If you're just in crisis, you know, just having a really awful day, call a crazy person like me. Because I'm not going to be judgmental. I'm not going to, they call it shooting all over you. I'm not going to, you should do this and you should do that. I'm just going to, as a friend of mine says, I'm going to co-sign your BS. Oh, my Lord. Oh, I can't believe that happened. Oh, dear God. How did you survive that? Because people say to me, what should I say to this person? Don't say anything. Just listen.
You look like the pinnacle of what someone who wants to be a working comedian wants to be, you know, but you've struggled with depression, suicidal ideation. So, yeah, I think that's going to be something that people are curious about. It's like, why does someone who seems to have everything or success, why do they struggle?
It's a double-edged sword, and I did a blog post on this, of being high-functioning. I mean, people have said to me, depression and suicide, that's fashionable. You don't have, do you really have thoughts of suicide? And I love to stagger them back with this. Yeah, I could tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like, which means you just take a step back. Oh, dear God, I can't believe you said that out loud. Well, you're questioning whether I have an illness or not. It's, do you ever go to somebody who, I was just diagnosed with prostate cancer. Do you really have prostate cancer? Well, let me drop my pants. Let's take a look. that's the thing. I've got a cousin with bipolar. She said, I wish I had cancer because I'd be bald and people would be doing fundraisers for me and bringing me casseroles. But bipolar, nobody comes, nobody calls, nobody will have anything to do with me. And my mom won't let me live at her house. It's, that's the problem. Like PTSD, soldiers got PTSD. And PTSD is not just soldiers. I mean, there's other many, many other causes. But, a soldier comes back from Iraq and they've lost both legs. Well, you can a lot of sympathy and whatever, but if it's inside their head, if they look normal, if they're relatively high functioning, then it's very difficult to, and I'm a comedian. You're depressed? No, not you. And sometimes I feel guilty because I have a good life, a lovely wife and a great job. She's got a great job. We have health insurance, wonderful rescue animals, and it's a good life. So sometimes I feel like, God, with all the people who have it so much worse in the world than I do, how can I be depressed? Well, it's just organic. It's just the way I'm wired.
Why do you think that so many comedians struggle with depression?
Well, that was my third TED Talk. When I did my first one, people go, how do you come up with the ideas for the rest? Well, it just bubbles up in my head. I think a friend of mine, Mike McDonald from Canada, comedian, now deceased, said there are two kinds of comedians, diagnosed, undiagnosed. My third TED Talk, it's called Mental with Benefits, The Evolutionary Advantages of Mental Illness. And the premise is this. What if those of us diagnosed with a mental illness are not living with a genetic mutation, but an amazing evolutionary adaptation? What if it is, as Malcolm Gladwell says of such things in his book, David and Goliath, a desirable disadvantage? And what if we treat the mental illness with therapy and medication and whatever, and then embrace, energize, enhance the mental ableness. Because I kept talking to people who had a child who had a mental illness, bipolar, depression, whatever. That was always the first paragraph. Second paragraph was always, yeah, but they're smart, they're funny, they're creative, they're artistic, they're athletic. And I began to wonder, there's got to be a connection. So I did some research, and it seems as if that people who are mentally ill and not completely dysfunctional have this other set of mental abilities, mental ableness. I said to my sister, who has anxiety and depression, I said, like superheroes or superpowers. She goes, superpowers? We're not the X-Men. We're the Zen X-Men. But that's so that mental illness is not a singularity, but actually it's a duality, in that part of it is mental illness, and on the flip side is mental ableness. I believe my comic ability, the way I process, is simply the flip side of my mental illness. Because I can teach you to write stand-up comedy. I can teach you to perform stand-up comedy. But I cannot teach you how to process the information that I get through my eyes and ears that becomes jokes. Does that make sense? I'm on a plane. I'm on a Delta flight. Right after they made it okay for you to use your cell phone or your iPad on takeoff or landing, as long as it's in the airplane mode. Well, the problem for the flight attendant is none of that's written down anywhere, but she's got to tell us about it. So I'm on the edge of my seat thinking she's got to improv. So she gets to the end of the usual seat cushion, you know, oxygen mask, whatever. And this is Delta, so she's very Southern. Floor path lighting. Then she goes, ladies and gentlemen, due to new FAA regulation. You can almost hear her thinking. Due to new FAA regulation. Then she gets inspired and she goes, due to new FAA regulation, if you have small equipment, you can continue playing with it. So I'm bent over double laughing. Nobody else on the plane is. My seatmate thinks I've lost my mind. He goes, what? I go, let's review. Before we can review, she comes back on and goes, if you have large equipment, you're going to have to shove that under the seat in front of you. So I'm down on my knees. Everybody else on the plane heard exactly what I heard, including my seatmate. But nobody processed it the way I did. And I think that processing is the flip side of my, you know, my mental. And there's actually a crossover ability. Somebody said, how do you memorize your TEDx? Well, one of the symptoms of depression is you ruminate. You think about the same things over and over and over again. So I have harnessed that power. By the time I get to the TEDx stage, I have been through that thing from every angle 100 times, out loud, to myself, driving along. I just let that rumination thing run. And I decided late last year, if somebody said, here's a pill, Frank, you take this one pill one time, you will never be depressed again. You'll never have another thought of suicide. The only side effect is you will no longer process information the way you do as a stand-up comedian. And I would say, look, give the pill to somebody who has it worse than I do, because I'm not willing to give up. And I think maybe it's not a duality, mental illness, mental ableness. It may be an actual mental otherness. It's a third category. You know, it's neurodiversity. And I think and when I do a TED Talk, I try to make a point at the end. I think if we could convince a child who has a mental illness, yeah, you got that mental illness, Bobby, but you know what? Here's the good news. You have this mental ableness, this superpower that your peers can't not even approach. It would change the frame for the child from disabled to other-abled. And for their peers, yeah, Bobby's a little strange, but, you know, have you seen him draw? Less bullying, less stigma. And I said, look, take the IEP, the Individual Education Plan. Take some kid with OCD, and for God's sakes, put him in the STEM program, science, technology, education, mathematics, because every one of those curricula have every one of those subjects, there's one right answer to every question. What better for a kid with OCD who is, you know, just compulsive about order and precision, and then steer him in a career direction to a company or an industry like accounting where they value attention to detail. They'll celebrate the fact that he is amazing when it comes to the balance sheet. Somebody who is dyslexic, forget STEM, too many numbers and words and letters and stuff, you know, arts, humanities, and multi-level complex tasks. Kids with dyslexia, people with dyslexia, have better peripheral vision generally than the rest of us. They tend to see in a panoramic fashion as opposed to just directly in front of them. And they have the amazing ability oftentimes to find the anomaly in anything. The joke I wrote was never play with a dyslexic. Never play Where's Waldo with a dyslexic for money, because he's going to open a book and go, right there, you can't see that. So you design a curriculum that you know, like I said, arts, humanities, and so forth, and then steer them in a direction, let's say, like drone pilot. You're flying a drone over Afghanistan. It's pretty much one shade of brown or another, one piece of scrub brush or a rock. A person with dyslexia may be able to tell the difference between the rock that's just a rock and the rock that's a lid on a bunker, because they're great at picking out the anomaly. So that's, to your question, I believe that, yeah, that comics, entertainers, that our abilities come from the fact that we're, you know, wired. The downside is, you know, the wiring on the other side. sometimes takes a little medication, you know, a little getting used to. But it's I guess it's a mixed blessing. Are there people who are comedians who are not mentally ill? I suppose. I have yet to meet one. But, you know, and their suicide rate is higher than the average person. So who's to say?